The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So it's probably obvious that I'm going to talk about the 10 ox herding pictures this morning. And I'm afraid that this won't be visible to many, if any of you, but I think I can say enough that we'll understand what's going on. So the 10 ox herding pictures are a series of pictures. We begin to see versions of them, and there are various versions around the 600s. And this particular version was drawn or painted in the 12th century in China. This is in China, by a monk that the Japanese call Kakuan. And again, this particular version became very popular in Japan in the 15th century. And then famous in the West because Paul Reps reproduced it in his book Zen Flesh, Zen Bones, which I think came out in the 50s. So it goes way back to then. I think, too, that those of you who have read How to Grow a Lotus Blossom will find correspondences between the experiences that Reverend Master Jiyu records there and these 10 pictures. But I'll leave that for your own investigation. So the 10 ox herding pictures are about an ox herder and an ox. And the ox is, and it's sometimes called a bull, is a simile for meditation practice, for the untamed mind, for the enlightened mind, for Buddha nature. So we have, it runs the gamut. And the pictures tell the story of the spiritual journey, of the progression of Zen training, illustrating the stages of a practitioner's progression towards the purification of mind or enlightenment, using the taming of the ox as a metaphor. And the progression goes on to full enlightenment and the return of the practitioner to the world, now acting in the world out of wisdom. So that's what's illustrated here in rough form. I actually think it's most helpful, most revealing, to think of it as a journey from duality to non-duality, from separateness towards oneness or non-duality. One modern commentator refers to it as a journey towards fundamental wholeness. And I find that to be a very nice way of putting it. We come back to our fundamental wholeness. It's the journey towards the realization of our true nature, our Buddha nature, or Buddha mind. An endless adventure of boundless opening. Endless, and it's an adventure, and it's boundless, and it's opening. How's that for one sentence? I have a pointer here. It's not very sophisticated. I should probably have a laser pointer, right? Anyway, this is the first picture up here at the top in this circle. And that depicts a young man. It could be a woman. You don't have to be young. I don't think in 12th century Japan they thought of women setting out on these kinds of adventures. And this young person is alone in a landscape. And this aloneness, I think, is actually quite important because I think we undertake this journey alone, even when we're practicing in a monastery or in the world with lots of friends and family and people all around us, doing it all together. It's an internal journey that is not unaffected by those around us, but which fundamentally we do ourselves. So there he is, walking through the landscape, he or she, and he's already having a rough time. He's lost, exhausted, in pain, discouraged, making his way through ever higher mountains and across ever wider rivers, further and further from home, Though, you know, these pictures look awfully peaceful to me. Oh, I should add, I'm sorry, I forgot to say, that each of these pictures comes with a small paragraph and a four-line poem of explanation. So a lot of what I'm saying is informed by the words that go with the pictures. Okay, so here's our hero or heroine, lost and beleaguered. I guess I would say that it's perhaps a universal human thing to find ourselves with some kind of great longing or yearning for something more, something else, something other than here, the heart seeking for that which is its true home. And that this yearning or seeking for our true home is the initiating of a great search, with capital G and S, the religious or spiritual quest. And this person out here in this landscape is embarked on that spiritual quest, which already isn't easy. This is the arousing, in my mind, of bodhicitta, or the way-seeking mind. And it's what brings us to the monastery, whether we're monks or lay folks, whatever venue we come to practice, we come in part because of this yearning. To me, it's the asking of a question, a fundamental question like, what is life all about? What's the meaning of life? Is life worth living even, you know? And how am I to best spend it? River Master Daishin Morgan poses it as the question, what is this? Each moment asking that question, what is this that is right here, right now? In the end, to me, it's a question with no content. It's just simply question. We are question. I am question. And this is the great doubt. So we're on a great search because of a great doubt. But even right here at the beginning, this very first picture with this person in this landscape looking for this ox, which is his own true nature or her own true nature, the verse says, till now, the ox never has been lost. Why then do you need to search for it? Turning away from your own awakening, or another translation says, only because of separation from our true nature. And I include that because of the word separation there, which I think is important. Turning away from your own awakening, or only because of separation from our true nature, you become estranged from it. So already right here at the beginning, it's being pointed out to us that we already have what we're looking for, and the whole search doesn't need to happen anyway. But because we're entangled in greed and fear and good and bad, we must continue. We can't see our true nature, and we suffer from the illusion that we're separate from it. So off we go into the wilderness. Picture number two right here is called Seeing the Traces. And in this picture, our young person comes across footprints of the ox, seeing the traces of the ox. So this is the first hint of the presence of the ox, that maybe there really is something more that actually exists. Sees them everywhere. And this is the stage at which we orient ourselves within a tradition, find a path, follow a particular way with a capital W. This entails reading and reciting our scriptures, reading the sutras, becoming familiar with the teachings of the Buddha, in our case. And these paintings were done in reference to Buddhism, by the way. Doing the specific practices, keeping the precepts, learning how to meditate and actually doing the meditation practice, and keeping to the forms of our particular practice. How we bow, how we offer incense, setting up an altar at home if that resonates with us, the various forms we take on that align us with a certain form of the practice, with a certain tradition, that give us a vehicle within which, or a context within which to undertake the search. So the tracks are not the ox, but they're a clue to the nature of the ox and where we might find the ox. And likewise, our practice doesn't actually cause enlightenment, but without it, there isn't any enlightenment. So at this stage, we've found a path or a framework or a tradition for our search, for answering our question and responding to the yearning. We've found a way to begin working towards fulfilling our aspiration. And at this point, perseverance and patience are the key. And the verse says, these traces no more can be hidden than one's nose. So all this time, you know, it seemed so not there. Again, the implication is that we're seeking for what we already are. It's as close as our nose, not off in the distance, and not foreign to us. Now, picture three, right here, is catching a glimpse. Here's the back end of the ox dashing into the undergrowth. And here's our young person chasing after him. So finally, he's caught a glimpse of the ox. This is, Reverend Master Jiu characterizes this as catching a glimpse of the untrained mind, our reckless mind, our wild monkey mind. And, you know, the experience of sitting in meditation and recognizing how wild and crazy your mind really is. I have this experience on a daily basis, I'm afraid. Another modern commentator says that this is Kensho, or Satori, or enlightenment experience. And keep in mind, please, that enlightenment experience is not enlightenment. This is catching a glimpse of our true nature, or of our original nature, of Buddha mind. So the interpretations here are running the gambit a bit, aren't they? From that point of view, the point of view of this being our first Kensho or enlightenment experience, it's in a sense our first perception of unity. The verse says, like salt in water. And the world has a sparkle to it. The verse says, the sun is warm, the wind is mild. So some of the distress is abating. And again, the verse says, here no ox can hide. And we recognize at some level that everything is the ox. Everything is Buddha, and it can't be missed. And then picture four down here is catching the ox, and we see the young person lassoing the ox. And this takes us back to this wild monkey mind version of things. This is a period of very great struggle, striving, and overt effort. So we're really having to try hard, work hard, put a lot of effort into our training. It can feel like a great struggle. You know, here you've got this wild ox, and you're trying to rope it. You know, you can imagine. Keeping a rein on the heart mind at this stage is no easy task. The verse says, his will and power are inexhaustible. Longing for sweeter grass, he wanders away. Boy, I can really relate to that. Oh, it's got to be better somewhere else. I think I'll go over there or over there. His mind still is stubborn and unbridled. If I wish him to submit, I must raise my whip. Breaking old habits is no easy thing. Now, this continues in picture five down here, which is called Taming the Ox. And in this picture, we actually see the ox herder leading the ox by a rope, which is through the ox's nose. Again, through these lovely landscapes. So this picture, to me, in some ways, is the heart of it all, because this is the process of day-to-day training. It's the point at which we're working on training the heart mind in minute detail and with great attention and care. The verse says, not for a moment put down whip or rein, pull again and again till it's tame and gentle. But with training, the mind does settle down and follows the master naturally, as the ox is doing in this picture. And as the ox becomes gentler, we learn to trust ourselves. We learn to trust our training and our ability to do it and the training itself, that it has results. Now, for those who think that Kensho or Satori happens here, they talk about this as post-Satori practice, in the sense that, having a religious experience is all well and good, but that's not the end of the story. You then have to actualize it and realize it and put it into practice. River Master Daizui calls this every minute meditation. This is the moment-to-moment mindfulness that we practice in our daily lives to see what it is that we're doing, recognize what it is we're doing, recognize what's before us, and learn how to change our mind, in effect. This is also the process of cleansing karma, which is a huge part of our training and practice. Reverend Master Jiu describes it in The Wild White Goose as pulling out all these little itty-bitty weeds, hundreds and thousands of itty-bitty weeds one at a time. My own experience of it is watching each mind moment, and recognizing, oh, darn, I'm mad again, or oh, darn, I'm jealous again, or whatever it is, and in a sense subverting that mind state and replacing it with kindness or generosity, as the case may be. So it's a kind of letting go of our conditioning and opting for the clarity that we are beginning to understand, whether we've had a Kensho or not. And I should say, most of us don't have Kenshos. And if you had to have a Kensho, that would mean that most of us are stuck at picture one and two. And that just isn't true, right? We all know that we're not stuck at picture one and two. So don't get too concerned about the Kensho way of explaining this. It's one metaphor to use, but it's not the only option that we have. We can have some of this clarity from our own training and practice, and each time we pull a weed, that clarity brightens. We no longer deceive ourselves into thinking that we can feed the ox our desires and attachments, our passions and delusions, the ox of fundamental wholeness. Will run away at the mere smell of them. That's how one modern commentator puts it. Find that graphically useful. In any case, it's nice to have insight, but now we have to actualize the insight, and this takes a lot of work. And that's what we're doing in this picture, making our insight real, our sight of the ox real, bringing it alive, and enabling it to make a difference in our lives and in the lives of others. This is what makes any experience, enlightened experience, if you will, or any experience of insight, something that is more than just a momentary experience. It's how we stabilize it and enable it to be the way that we're actually living. And at this point, we can actually relax a little bit. This work requires quite a bit of vigilance, but this ox herder leading the ox is a little bit more at ease than he's been in the earlier pictures. So that comes in our practice, and we can see that our work is beginning to have an effect on our practice. And this sense of relaxing is augmented in the next picture down here at the very bottom. That's picture 6, riding the ox home. Oh, I meant to mention, somebody mentioned to me yesterday, picture 4, catching the ox, or bull. Cat Stevens apparently named his album Catch Bull at 4 after this fourth ox herding picture. Isn't that interesting? Anyway, we're on picture 6 now, riding the ox home. At this stage of the practice, we can navigate the complexities of life with some kind of ease. We can face, the turmoil or distress or just the busyness that life brings us with some kind of ease. The ox herder is sitting on the ox, riding it gently. He's got the rein in his hand. He's playing a flute. Does he have the rein in his hand? No, the reins are dropped over the ox, and he's playing a flute. So there he is, conveying a kind of effortless activity or relaxation amidst the difficulties personified by the ox of life. There's nothing to be bothered about. There's nothing to be bothered about. So there begins to be a sense of unity as the ox herder experiences him or herself and the ox as one being, acting together, acting in concert with each other. Okay? The verse says, "Onward I go, no matter who may wish to call me back." And I think this is a really important sentence because it points to the fact that there comes a place in our spiritual journey where we can't turn back and nothing will distract us or dissuade us from it. And, you know, for a long time you can think, well, should I do this or not? Is it working, isn't it? Is it worth it or isn't it? Is there something better or isn't there? And all that stuff. But at some point, we can't turn away from it anymore. We've gone too far. We're in too deep. It means too much. And that's kind of what's beginning to happen here. Onward I go, no matter who may wish to call me back. Picture 7 over here is called Ox Forgotten. Ox Forgotten. And this shows the ox herder sitting in front of a hut, gazing out on a beautiful landscape. Looks like a full moon over the mountains. So we can think of this as finally ego's gotten out of the way a bit and self is forgotten. If you think of the ox as that unruly self that we're constantly trying to tame, he's gone, the ox is gone. So ego's out of the way, self is forgotten. And it's actually only when self is forgotten that religious experience is possible in one sense, even if the forgetting is only momentary. Now at this point, there's no need to search because really the search comes from the self. It's the self that wants something better and more, or bigger or brighter. And when we put down the self, or let go of the self, or we forget about the self for a while, the search no longer has any meaning or relevance. And we can drop it off, or we do drop it off without even thinking about it. And at this point, even Buddha nature is superfluous. And when Buddha nature is superfluous, Buddha mind is functioning unseen. So we're at the point where we can sit I like the way Dogen puts it, meditation is the Dharma gate to repose and joy. So our practice is the gate to this kind of repose and joy where we're not concerned with either self or Buddha, but can just be with what is, with a bit of serenity and tranquility. All that striving is something we are able to put down, at least momentarily. The search itself is a kind of suffering, a kind of distress. And now this distress or suffering has come to an end. I think of this as the stage of not to. There's nothing outside ourselves to search for. Again, the whole journey takes place within our own hearts. And it is our mind that creates the monsters, and it's our mind that can put them down. One of the commentators writes, "If you are still thinking that life must have a purpose, then you have not yet arrived at the last station at the end of the railroad of life. When you arrive at the last station at the end of the line, you play." I just appreciated that way of looking at it. Okay, picture 8 is radically different from all the pictures, and probably all of you who can see this can see that it's different. It's an empty circle, just a plain white circle, luminous circle. And that picture is called Ox and Self Forgotten. There's nothing there. And this is seeing the source of the mind. So Kensho, or enlightenment experience, is seeing Buddha nature, or our own original nature, but it's not actually becoming a Buddha. So one could think of this as, if you had a Kensho back here at picture 3, now at picture 8 you've become Buddha. Or you've achieved, if this was a little bit of enlightenment, over here at picture 8 you've achieved fully perfected enlightenment. One could think of it that way. Or one could see this as we train, slowly, 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 we gain understanding and realization and a deeper relationship to the training and the practice. And by the time we've gotten to picture 8, those slow, small increments have accumulated in such a way that we really do have this profound understanding. And I think it's like that for most of us. And picture 8 could be simply a depiction of what happens when, you know, you're sitting in meditation and you have an insight and you suddenly see something clearly for the first time. Or you're washing the dishes and you have an insight and you see something clearly for the first time. So I think we can think of this empty circle in all of those ways. But part of what is trying to be shown here is that our training leads us to this deeper understanding of non-duality. This is the place of non-duality or fundamental wholeness. It's what we've been looking for so long, why we undertook the search to begin with. My master used to say that this is the place where religion begins, and that everything up to there is psychology. And I think there's something interesting about that comment, because there does seem to be a kind of sudden shift here. And on the other hand, I don't think it's quite that cut and dry. And particularly, I mean, if there's Kensho back here at 3, then religion is in there. And I think the whole thing has strands of both religion and psychology in it. And maybe here we do see this shift. What's the shift that makes something religion as opposed to not religion? I don't know that I can put that into words. It's, you know, it's that sense of nothing to search for, nothing, no goal. Buddha is right here, right now, and everything. Something like that. This is the full realization of emptiness in its empty form, the complete falling away of body and mind that Dogen talks about. There's no ox, there's no man, there's no whip, no reins, no home, no landscape, no practitioner, no goal, nothing to seek, nothing to do, no awakening, no dharma, no self, no Buddha, no eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind. This is the deep realization of emptiness, as boundless empty space, where no thing exists as the mind construes things. I think of it as a place of great stillness, maybe a place of peace and calm, but a place of great stillness. And the verse for this picture says, how may a snowflake exist in a raging fire? Emptiness. How may a snowflake exist in a raging fire? Okay, then picture 9 over here is a landscape. There's nobody in it, no animals in it. It's just a landscape, a beautiful, peaceful-looking landscape. And it's entitled Returning to the Source. And to me, these two pictures are, in a sense, we enter into them both at the same time. And they're the flip side of each other. This is full emptiness, picture 9. As Reverend Master Jiu would call it, full emptiness. In picture 8, we had empty emptiness, and now we have full emptiness. Everything has returned. Everything is there. All of our lives, all that's around us, you know, where we live, what we live in, it's all there. So we could say with picture 8, with enlightenment, there is nothing. And with picture 9, with enlightenment, nothing obstructs. And we can talk here about little enlightenments and big enlightenments, so don't discount, you know, your own experience here. We could say that picture 9 is one of those pictures that's letting us know that all things aid and teach, and everything can be used for our own benefit. And we train with things just as they are. Things are just as they are. And in a sense, not in a sense, truly, our heart mind contains the whole universe. There is nothing that's actually outside of ourselves. Things are perfect from the start. Now, at this stage, there begins to be the arising, well, I don't think I want to say it that way. I was going to say there begins to be the arising of compassion, but that's been happening all along, right? But we're beginning the descent of the mountain, of, you know, returning from this place of great wonder that we stumble across in picture 8 to our ordinary everyday lives. And that's picture 10 right here. In picture 10, what we see is somebody who looks like our ox herder over here, but who isn't. He's talking to this monk here. This is this monk is our ox herder transformed from his spiritual journey into Hote. Hote was a legendary, perhaps historically existed monk in China, big fat guy with a smile on his face all the time who carried around a bag of stuff and gave things away to people who needed them, spread good cheer wherever he went. And I think the idea here is that this person on the right is, you know, stopping to talk to him. And Hote, who is a manifestation of Maitreya, the future Buddha, is helping him out. The picture is called Returning to the Marketplace with Bliss Bestowing Hands. And I love that because it's us actually being in our lives with our families, with our children, with our parents, with our friends, with our careers, our work, our volunteer organizations, the things we do for fun, all of it, we're in the midst of that life with bliss-bestowing hands. So we've come down from the mountain. You can't stay up there. You can't stay up there in the bliss states of nirvana forever. You've got to come down. You've got to come back to the world. And that's the point at which it becomes really incumbent on us to express our understanding through wise and compassionate means. And this is where our realization, if we can call it that, is both tested and actualized. As I think we all know from our lives, right? That our lives test us. And they test our ability to put into practice, you know, just keeping the precepts, right? And through how we respond to that test, our understanding is actualized. It's made manifest. I think of us as being exactly the same as we were when we started, but entirely different. Hote doesn't look the same as the ox herder. There's another set of scrolls that is completely different, or quite different from this, that shows the progression of the spiritual life through the Buddhist path, that ends with the ox herder looking exactly like the ox herder looked when he or she began. And I think that we do. We look exactly the same. We don't hang out a sign and say, you know, I am the great one and I will help you. We just live our lives. But the fact is that something's different. Something internal has shifted. And that registers. People somehow, it makes a difference for people. So we become the teachings of the Buddha manifesting in the world for the benefit of all. And we become the teachings of the Buddha manifesting in the world for for the benefit of all. And this is our great compassion to beings. So we actually make this journey for others as well as for ourselves. It says in the verse about Hote, I am ragged and dust laden and I'm ever blissful. It says in the paragraph that goes with the picture that he goes into the bars and brothels and spreads joy and good cheer. Which is, you know, which is a way of saying we go where we need to go. And we aren't necessarily contaminated by our surroundings, but being who we are, we can offer help. Not by overtly offering it, but by just being who we are. It's, in a sense, if we ourselves are no mind, then without saying or doing anything, people who come into contact with us take away some of that no mind. It's contagious. And this is how Zen helps people. We do the practice, it becomes who we are, it's contagious, and it helps self and other. So we become Maitreya, bestowing benefit on everyone we meet. And his inner radiance, Maitreya's inner radiance, brings light and hope to those in despair and darkness. And I think it's really wonderful that Maitreya or Hote in this last picture is laughing. That at the end of the spiritual journey, there's this, what I like to think of as unutterable joy. And his face portrays that. So that's the 10 pictures. In this particular version, the 10 pictures are configured in this circle, as you can see. And I think that's really important because I think that what that conveys is that when we get to the last one, we go on to the first one. And you actually have to start again. And that we don't make this journey just once in our lives. We may make it several times. Or there may be one big journey, but there are several little journeys inside that. And there may be journeys inside those littler journeys. Or we may be working on several phases of this at once, or at another time one becomes important and the others are less important. I don't think it's just simply walking a linear path. And it's something we have to do over and over again, remind ourselves of over and over again, until we really do become Buddha and and have fully perfected enlightenment. And in a way, this is a really simple story. You know, this innocent person's walking through the landscape, enjoying him or herself, and I've often wondered, is he oblivious or is he already, you know, full of that deep longing? When he sees these tracks and he's intrigued, he's caught. And they lead him on this adventure of hardship and also of awesome wonder. And after all the great, you know, the hardship, lost in the mountains and fording rivers that are uncrossable and cut by brambles and broken from falling. And he finds, or she finds, what he or she is looking for, which we could call Buddha nature, original mind. And then finally, you know, he or she gets on with life. And so, simple story, right? Well, as one modern commentator puts it, so long as there are these two selves within us, that is Buddha nature and an ordinary mortal, we're not truly living. When these two become completely one, we have achieved Satori, or Kensho, or enlightenment, or whatever word you want to use there, some kind of realization. To finally attain this is what we achieve, what we seek to achieve in our practice. So long as there are these two selves, I'm reading it again, so long as there are these two selves within us, that is Buddha nature and ordinary mind, we are not truly living. Isn't that interesting? When there's that separation or that divide exists. When these two become completely one, we have achieved Satori. I'm sorry, I can't read today. To finally attain this is what we seek to achieve in our practice. And I would add that then, as the 10th picture tells us, We just live ordinary lives as ordinary mortals, expressing Buddha mind, however that happens through us, quite naturally, and without even conscious intention on our part. So we begin with great doubt, which leads to great searching, which contains within it great difficulty, and leads eventually to great ease or relaxation or repose, finally to great emptiness, and then to great joy. So this is our life of training. This is the arc that I see that we travel through as we go along each day, pulling one little weed after another. I don't think there's anything more we could wish for. Thank you.